Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Today, for your listening pleasure, we have an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on September 15th, 2013, under the headline, Train Robbery Turned Into Onboard Gunfight with the Law. Here we go. It was early summer 1914, and an Oregon and Washington Railway Navigation Company passenger train was just passing over the summit of the Blue Mountains between LeGrand and Pendleton. The crewmen were running the train slow, checking the brakes for the long downhill run ahead. Meanwhile, three men at the back of the train were checking their guns. A train robbery was about to go down, one of the very last Old West-style train robberies ever. And before it was over with, it would turn into one of the very last Old West-style six-shooter gunfights, too. Clarence Stoner didn't look much like outlaw royalty. He had a mild, earnest, boyish face, and all of his relatives considered him the last person they'd ever expect to become a train robber. But he was a cousin of two of the West's most notorious desperados, Charles and Hugh Whitney, and a member of Butch Cassidy's Wild Bunch gang in his home state of Wyoming. He was now out in Oregon and running with a close friend of his cousin's, a gambler named Charles Manning, and an outlaw sheepman from Kentucky named Albert Metters. In late July, Manning got word that train number 5 on the OWRN line, Chicago to Portland, would be carrying a significant sum of cash in the express car. So he got together with Stoner and Metters and proposed that they do the job. As a place to do it, Manning picked a remote spot between Camilla and Meacham at the summit of the Blue Mountains. At this remote place, Manning knew the train would have to slow down and check its brakes. When it did, the three of them would be ready. The outlaws bought a getaway car, a brown sedan of unknown make, although apparently it was not a Ford since it wasn't black. Manning also obtained enough dynamite to breach the express car. He anticipated that the clerk would barricade the door as soon as he learned the train was being robbed to protect the strongbox. Finally, all was in readiness. The three desperados traveled to the Camilla station, bought tickets, boarded at the rear. The train rolled on westward up the side of the mountain toward its date with destiny. As the train neared the summit of the pass, it slowed down, which was the outlaw's signal. Out came the guns, and starting at the back of the train, they simply collected all the train crew members and marched them forward. Manning pulled the emergency stop, the engineer slammed on the brakes, and there the train sat, poised a few dozen yards beyond the crest, at the start of a miles-long, winding 2.5% downhill grade, air brakes locked on. Confidential to vintage steam train buffs, yes, in about 20 minutes. Scary, no? But we'll talk more about that in a minute. Back to our story. Stoner went forward and collected the engineer and the fireman. At gunpoint, he marched them back and locked them in the baggage car. The first big shock of the day came moments later, when Manning approached the express car and demanded entry. To his surprise, the clerk let him come right in, rather than barring the door and refusing. Once inside, he immediately learned why. There was no money inside. Because of a printer's error on the timetables, the train was carrying the wrong number. He and his friends were robbing the wrong train. Hoping to salvage something for their efforts, the robbers now turned their attention to the passenger cars. Leaving Stoner to guard the captured train crew, Manning and Metters started going down the rows, robbing each passenger in turn. This turned out to be a bad plan. Because inside the passenger cabin, sitting in the back row, was Morrow County Deputy Sheriff George McDuffie. McDuffie waited for a moment when both Manning and Metters were distracted and then stood up and pulled his revolver, apparently planning to arrest the two at gunpoint. He was carrying, for some reason, an old-school black powder revolver, even though it was now 1914. Manning, the gambler, rolled the dice, whipping his pistol around to shoot. This was not a good idea. As it turns out, Deputy McDuffie seems to have been something of a gunfighting ninja. Both weapons fired at about the same time. Manning's shot hit McDuffie high in the chest, inflicting a wound that would have been very serious or maybe even fatal if the bullet hadn't hit a metal pencil case and pack of cards in McDuffie's breast pocket. McDuffie's shot went straight through Manning's heart, and the officer followed it with a second shot within inches of the first and a third shot that hit the outlaw in the head. All this from an old-school single-action six-shooter firing black powder cartridges. McDuffie's three shots had filled the car with smoke. Manning was dead before he hit the ground, and Metters couldn't see well enough to return fire even had he been inclined to do so, so instead he took advantage of the smoke screen to cover a hasty retreat. He leaped off the train and ran into the bushes, closely followed by Stoner, and the two of them got away with just $750 worth of loot. When the two hard-pressed robbers got back to where they had cached their car, they seemed to have found a third and final unpleasant surprise waiting for them. Some accounts of this robbery say there was a fourth man who was waiting by the car for them. If so, this fourth man double-crossed them, because the next day the two of them were arrested, trudging along the railroad tracks 20 miles from the scene, trying to make it to LeGrand on foot. The car, or the apocryphal fourth man, were never seen again. It seems very unlikely that the fourth man actually existed, because if he had, they would have been angry enough about it to have fingered him when they talked to the cops. Quote, "I am mighty glad to come in and have it all over with," Metter told the cops after he was lodged in the county jail. Quote, "That is exactly the way I feel about it," Stoner agreed. "This is the first time either of us has ever been in any trouble of this kind before in our lives." For Stoner, it was the last time. After he was released from prison, he settled down and led a perfectly normal and successful life. He worked hard, bought a farm in Idaho, raised a family, and never talked about his previous career, even to his children. After moving back to Oregon, he died in 1974 in Newport at age 91. Meadows was another story. For him, the train robbery was the beginning of a life of crime punctuated by stretches of hard time. Pardoned out of the joint in 1918, he was back again the following year after getting caught burgling a house in Missouri. He spent the next 20 years filling up his rap sheet with more burglaries and bootlegging charges and even a manslaughter rap. He changed his name several times and disappeared from the records in the late 1930s. As for Deputy McDuffie, he was hailed as a hero, not just for foiling the robbery, but for saving the lives of everyone on board that train. M.J. Buckley, the general superintendent of the railroad line, told the Morning Oregonian that the air brakes on a stationary train of that weight on such a steep grade would only hold for 15 or 20 minutes. So the whole time the robbers were on board, that clock was ticking, and the only people who could do anything about it were locked in the baggage car. Quote, "It would have been impossible to hold a train like that on a grade without losing some air," Buckley said. "As soon as the air begins to leak, the brakes don't hold long, and had the train ever started, nothing in the world could have stopped it. It would have torn down the hill and at the first curve undoubtedly would have left the rails and plunged over the mountainside." Key sources of this story have included works by Austin Schultz, the Portland Morning Oregonian, and the Spokane Daily Chronicle. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find full citations and visuals that go with today's show. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. Until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day and the subsequent weekend with good stuff. Bye now.